Dr. Lippman, which you commanded me. You said absolutely must call me Dr. Lippman. Will not accept any other name whatsoever. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We'll switch to more casual language, Nicole. I am interested in hearing about you and your backstory. Selfishly, I've been following from afar, and you do some amazing content. You don't talk too much about yourself, which is whatever, you know, you're too focused on things that are more important. But I'd love to hear a bit about you, your backstory, you know, your points of interest and how you came to do what you do now.
So I got interested in nutrition because around 2017, 2016 or so, I started experiencing some health issues of my own. And what was going on was that I had like really bad acne and I wasn't getting my period. And then so I went to the doctor and I got diagnosed with PCOS. And at the time I was also on Instagram following a lot of what I now understand are like the wellness trends and sort of like the wellness people. And I happened to stumble upon a 21-day food elimination challenge from someone I was following at the time that I was interested in. And I just decided to kind of do it out of nowhere. So I started the challenge, but an important context is like my diet at the time, like I wasn't cooking often. I was eating a lot of fast food. I was doing my postdoc. And so I was like working a lot and I just didn't have a lot of space to like dedicated to cooking. And so I was kind of eating on the go and eating whatever. And I did the food elimination challenge. And on the 21st day of the challenge, I got my period. And at that time, I did not get my period for almost 9 months. And so I thought that was incredible, like to have that kind of experience. And so the next day was a Sunday. And I spent most of that Sunday just doing a lot of research related to what is this connection between diet and PCOS. And I got really fascinated by what I was reading and also just like my own personal experience going through that. And then about 3 months later, I signed myself up to be part of a nutritional therapy practitioner certification course through the Nutritional Therapy Association. I did that course. That was like a 9 or 10 month online course and didn't know at the time that that was not a legitimate course or certification to receive. But I didn't know that. And then like a year later, I started making content related to nutrition and again, didn't really know that I was putting out inaccurate information because I was sort of fed that information and thought that that was real. And then shortly after that, I got contacted by the Center for Nutritional Psychology and they wanted me to start writing one of their courses related to this connection between the gut microbiome and mental health. So I started just reading research papers. And as I was reading research papers, I became more and more disillusioned. I was like, oh my God, what I'm reading is in no way reflecting the kind of information that I'm seeing online, like literally at all. So I was like kind of amazed and I was like, wow, I need to make content about this because everything that I'm reading about is inaccurate and people are just making up all these false claims. So that's kind of what led me to make the kind of content that I'm making now and really like putting a lot of effort into becoming more of an expert related to this diet mental health relationship. Because I'm really, for some reason, very motivated and concerned by like having people just have accurate information about mental health and not sensationalized information. So that's kind of like what led me to creating Feed Your Mental online, at least.
It's unlikely that the average person will stumble upon like really evidence-based people at the start. I just think that it's, if you're like, hey, you like log onto Instagram, you like make an account for the first time and you start interacting online, it's unlikely the thing that you are fed first and if you know nothing about a topic, it's unlikely you'll arrive at your account first, right? You'll arrive at Huberman and Jordan Peterson like a lot sooner than you'll arrive at your account. And I think that I just want to make sure, and you're not doing this, but I'm just saying like, shame, there's a feeling of shame sometimes where it's like, oh my God, I bought into all this stuff, turned out to be bullshit, and I wasted so much time and money. It's like, here's a person I'm talking to, you, who literally began her journey in this way. And by the way, that's not a unique story. I signed up for Mark Hyman's like integrative nutritionist course one time, you know, a decade ago or whatever, like, because, you know, getting into this space, the shit that people were saying that was more polarizing, more hyperbolic, more interesting, you know, caught my eye more. And it's what actually got me excited, you know, about nutrition, about, you know, what there might be beyond lifting weights and eating fruits and vegetables. And, you know, it's kind of unfortunate, but I just think that, you know, you would echo the point of like, yeah, that's not abnormal. There's nothing to be ashamed about if that's like been your route into this space. But hopefully podcasts like this help pull people to, you know, into the light a little bit, so to speak.
Exactly. I think also it highlights another point where, like I already had my doctorate and I was still fooled. So it's less about intelligence and education and another field. Like I had expertise in this field, but I didn't have expertise in nutrition and I was still fooled by the information that was being presented online. So this, I feel like that speaks to another large point of like anybody can be fooled because there's other tactics like going on in the process of it.
Yeah, I feel like the last 2 years of doing this podcast have been having guests on that are experts in a certain field and being like, hey, what are the pieces of misinformation that are pissing you off the most right now? You know, like I just like, that's why I'm like making notes for you. I'm like, basically like, hey, when we're looking at, you know, misunderstandings between mental health and diet and exercise, and there's a lot of things that you discuss here in terms of mental health, but like what are the biggest myths that we want to bust? And we're going to go through some of them today, but I just find myself I'm thinking of whatever the last like 10 podcast guests, I'm just like, you know what, you're really smart at this thing, come on and tell me what are the BS things people are falling for, what should they focus on instead? And that's kind of what we're going to do today, talking about diet, exercise, depression, ADHD, autism, gut health, mental health. I have no idea if we're going to get through all of that, but that would be cool if we could touch on everything a tiny bit. And so we could kick things off with diet / exercise and depression. And I think that it's a bit of a heavy topic because, and maybe you would want to start with the clinical definition for depression. I think that that's kind of important. Misunderstanding between like diet and exercise, like is part of a happy life and, you know, maybe a net de-stressor over time, but that's different than clinical depression. So I'd love to, you know, whatever, I'm gonna throw a million questions at you. You can start where you want, which is we're gonna talk about diet, exercise, and depression. I'd love to hear what we do know, what we don't know, and then we'll move to some best practices and kind of ways to communicate this topic.
Totally. So it's good to start with the definition of what clinical depression is, which is basically a set of, we know we're looking for a set of criteria and symptoms. The two main core symptoms of clinical depression is loss of interest and pleasure in most activities that once used to give a person pleasure, and then also sad or depressed mood for at least 2 weeks. So we have to have one of those to be present. And then there's usually an accompaniment of different kind of cognitive and behavioral disturbances. So usually there's changes in appetite. Usually there's changes in person's ability to focus and make decisions. Usually there's lethargy or fatigue. There can be feelings of hopelessness. So there's usually this constellation of symptoms that come with depression. And depression is very variable between individuals. It can look like one thing in one person and a totally different thing in another person, which is why this can be really complex and hard to treat. So, and, you know, we have very specific evidence-based interventions for clinical depression, which I can mention sort of afterwards. But that's really what we're looking at when we're looking at clinical depression. And the other caveat is that there has to be some kind of impairment in a person's life. So if there is not an impairment in a person's life, then we're not really looking at something that's clinical. We're probably looking at something that's subclinical or something that's in the more mild range.
Do you find that distinction between clinical and subclinical is a battle you fight a lot? Is it super relevant to people? Do you think that that's like an important thing where people are like, hey, we should understand what is clinical depression and what is just like a rough patch in your life or a day of sadness or something bad happens? Like what's more normal ebb and flow of emotions in life? And or are you like, hey, like that's not necessary? Like at what point do we make a distinction between the benefits of diet and exercise for clinical depression and subclinical, like trying to live an overall happy life?
Yeah, because there is a very real distinction. And this is what is, I think, really highlighted in the research that we currently have. And I see this in my own practice, which is, you know, the more severe a person is with regards to symptoms and also with regards to impairment in a person's life, the more interventions are needed. The other thing that we know is that the more severe a depression is, and also if you have a first degree relative who has major depressive disorder or some other depressive disorder, it's likely more of a genetic influence versus an environmental influence, right? So there's all of those things that we have to like take into account that then informs the process of actually making like a recommendation, right? Or prescription for treatment.
Before we go into diet and exercise, what are some of those other things that somebody, you know, if someone's like, oh, maybe I have subclinical depression, maybe I have actual clinical depression, and I'm thinking about what I can do for myself. We're going to get to diet and exercise and the evidence we do and don't have around the benefit there. But what other things might we throw into attacking that issue outside of just diet and exercise? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's incredibly poorly phrased, as if diet and exercise is somehow at the peak of the interventions. I'm just saying, before we talk about diet and exercise, what other sorts of interventions are we talking about?
Yeah, so here the distinction is, if someone's in a subclinical mild place for depression, and let's say it was caused by some kind of environmental precipitating event, meaning like maybe you lost your job, maybe a relationship ended, maybe something like that sort of caused a shift in your life. Usually that presentation, and there's not a significant impairment in a person's life, that presentation can be positively responsive to a lot of different interventions. So that could look like, you know, leaning on your support and your community and your family and your friends. That could be actually just problem solving, right? Working through actually finding another job, right? Because that usually resolves some of that issue for people. Maybe even a short bout of psychotherapy, because some people may need extra support and extra coping skills that, you know, they don't really have already. So from a subclinical mild place, a lot of lifestyle interventions, which is inclusive of diet and exercise, or even just basic stress management, as an example, that stuff can be really good for people in that place. But when we're looking at moderate to severe depression, that stuff usually is not enough for people to really like see any sort of clinically significant change in a person's life. That's where we're looking more at, like, that's psychotherapy, that's potentially medication, that's usually the combination of those things. And then we have other, you know, interventions if those things don't work either. So it's the order of operations, you know, in terms of a clinician recommending an intervention, is highly dependent on a person's symptoms, level of impairment, and is there a genetic influence? Is there a medical influence? Like, you know, what kind of stuff is going on there?
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense. When we look at, I mean, listen, I Googled almost searching for annoying headlines on this topic. And the headlines that you'll find when you Google diet, exercise, depression, they're astounding. Everything from basically summing up diet and exercise being more powerful than medical interventions during, you know, more powerful than medication when it comes to decreasing depressive symptoms and stuff like that. What do we actually know about that? And where do these headlines come from? How many threads of truth are there? And how do we actually harness diet and exercise for good without maybe oversimplifying depression and maybe overvaluing the benefit of diet and exercise in this very complex topic of mental health?
Totally. There tends to be, it's presented as this dichotomous solution. It's like either this or that. And nothing is like that. There's usually and. So it's not that clinicians are not recommending someone to exercise. That's not what's going on. We've been doing this for decades. We've been recommending people to maintain their health, their physical health, to maintain their fitness. But it's usually in combination with other factors. Also, we're not going to tell someone who barely can get out of bed to start exercising. That's just totally clinically inappropriate to do something like that. So in terms of what we actually know, though, the research on exercise and depression is way more impressive than the research that we have on diet and depression. So if we're looking at exercise, there's actually very solid evidence that suggests that some regular form of exercise, and it doesn't really matter what it is, that could be resistance training, that could be walking, that could be yoga, but some regular kind of activity is very beneficial overall in helping to reduce your risk of depression.
If you can do it, right? And that's always the caveat. And that's kind of left out of the headlines. That's left out of social media posts. Because if you're not a clinician and if you're not working with individual patients, you don't know that most people with depression have a really hard time regularly exercising. But the research is there and it's very, very solid.
How do you reconcile those two points where, like, if you're a clinician, you're working with somebody and you're like, I know that the research says, and, you know, almost logic would understand that getting up, moving your body, maybe it's being outside, doing something you enjoy, probably something good there, but I'm working with somebody who's probably not in a position to do that. How much do I push them? What's the downside of pushing them? Where's that line? How do, as a clinician working with a patient, how do we find the balance of you know, maybe they're not there right now, but that's something that, you know, is in the list of things that probably helps. How do we reconcile that?
Yeah, that's something, honestly, a lot of that I think comes with just like having experience working with individual patients. And then because you have to sort of understand, I hate to use this word holistically, but like, it's true. You have to understand the person from a comprehensive standpoint in order to know is this an appropriate recommendation? Because part of my job is to try to push a little bit, or like to challenge a little bit, to try to toe that line between like, you probably can do maybe a little more than you think you can, but also let's give you a lot of support so that you feel like you can actually achieve the thing that we're actually talking about, right? So it's a bit of a delicate line, and I think some of that comes down to just having clinical experience and getting used to what the presentation is for people and how you can kind of push people along.
I know you mentioned a bunch of different forms of movement and exercise, yoga and walking and resistance training. Could we speak a little bit more to what the research says about specific forms of movement? I'm pretty movement agnostic. All movement is good movement, especially if you enjoy it. There's benefit to every type of movement. I'm with that. Does the weight of the evidence point in the direction of if someone is agnostic about what they do, this would be the thing that you would recommend? Or is it very much like hey, anything's good, whatever you're ready for?
It's kind of whatever is good. So the leading researcher in this space is Brendan Stubbs, and he's published pretty extensively looking at depression particularly and exercise. And he really expresses that the main point that the consistent finding that they really see is that some elevation in heart rate. So even if you're like gardening and you're like walking and doing that, if there's some sort of elevation in the heart rate for a little bit more of an extended period of time, that's the thing that seems to be like really, really beneficial. And I think it might get a little hairy, let's say, if you're, you know, if you're going to a gym and you're working with a trainer, because there's an element, right, of additional support, and that sort of being probably some kind of moderating variable there. But absent of that, it's really any movement that a person does that gets their heart rate to be a little elevated for an extended period of time on a regular basis, that's like the really consistent finding, which I think is very hopeful for a lot of people, because it's not like you have to be married to a certain movement. You pick something that you like, because that is more motivating to do anyway.
Yeah, yeah. If you were to summarize how the layperson can think about this, myself being also the layperson here, a non-mental health professional, do you think, you know, if we're summarizing this in one sentence, and I'll say it and then you chew it back up and spit it back out more intelligently, but like, all movement is helpful. Exercise is likely helpful for decreasing depressive symptoms. All movement's probably good, depending on what you feel ready for and what you would enjoy. What's your perception of what would be enjoyable? Probably something that gets your heart rate up a little bit, maybe a benefit there. If you're at a state in which you can, you know, just mentally, again, get yourself up to doing it, that's something you're ready for. If you can't, go with other interventions for now and maybe work towards that. And no matter what, this should be done in conjunction with other things. This isn't a cure-all. It's not an if. It's not dichotomous. It's not this or other interventions. Would you rephrase that in a different way to kind of summarize it?
I think that's perfect, honestly, because those are the caveats that are really important. If you can do it, if you can ideally choose something that you enjoy, if you can create some regularity around that process, then definitely try to do it. Because the other thing that's kind of interesting is one of the biggest benefits and gains for people in terms of looking at outcomes is if you're coming from nothing to doing something, there seems to be a really big benefit in that space. And then, you know, sometimes that can kind of trail off a little bit once you're in like a regular momentum, and then you're not seeing as significant, let's say, leaps and bounds in terms of benefits. So, and I think also that's very hopeful too, because if you're literally kind of doing nothing and then you just start doing something, you're probably going to see more benefit there in that time period than you will if you're like in a more regular kind of consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's with freaking everything. I mean, I'm, you know, the diminishing returns in terms of the benefit of exercise on every physiological adaptation are just astounding. I mean, the percentage of benefits in metabolic health that you get from like 2 times a week, 30 minutes of resistance training, or, you know, meeting physical activity guidelines in terms of movement, compared to doubling or tripling that is incredibly marginal gains going more than that. All of that to say, the benefit of going from doing nothing to something and just doing what might seem to an avid fitness professional as very little, it's incredible the benefit you can get from very little when it comes to movement. And like you said, the biggest jump in benefit would be going from nothing to something. Absolutely. That's become my recent passion as a lifelong lazy person, seeking out absolute minimum effective dose, biggest ROI. And so, yeah, I appreciate that. I don't think you need, like you said, this isn't, I need to be 5 times a week resistance training, running, marathon training. This is like, more likely somebody who's not doing much, getting them to do something. There's probably the biggest benefit at that point.
Totally. Yeah, totally. And like that, and again, the research on exercise and depression is way more impressive and way more consistent. If we're looking at diet, if you're ready to think about diet, if we're looking at diet and depression, there's a number of things that we have to take into consideration. The current studies that we have related to looking at this relationship are kind of hairy because there's the majority of the randomized control trials that we have in this space do not use a clinically depressed population. They're using people who are in a subclinical range. And so for starting from a low place on the scale, and then we get a little lower, what clinically significant benefit is there really? So that's a huge caveat to keep in mind, that there's not many studies looking with using a clinical population. And the other thing that is important to keep in mind is that there was a couple of different meta-analyses that analyzed basically the randomized control trials that we have looking at diet quality and depression risk. And there was a few analyses that came out of that that I think are really helpful for us to think about. So one of those is that if the intervention is provided by a nutrition professional, there's a greater decrease in depression symptoms starting from baseline compared to the end of the study. That's really important because that suggests that a regular support from a nutrition professional is very significant in terms of allowing someone to potentially actually not just adhere to the diet, but for depression to actually decrease. That's huge. That's really huge. Another thing that they found in the study, which is also really significant, is in studies that used a formal diagnosis of depression, there was no relationship between diet quality and depression incidents. Studies that used self-reports, studies that used questionnaires, those were the studies that had a statistically significant finding in terms of diet quality reducing depression risk. That's really important. There's a couple of reasons why that's really important. One of those is on self-report questionnaires, even though they're validated and we use them in clinical practice, that's one small piece of the assessment process in terms of understanding whether or not someone has clinical depression. So on a self-report measure, people can indicate other behavioral dysfunctions. People can indicate, oh yeah, I am feeling more tired, or I do have some feelings of guilt, or I do have some appetite disturbances, but they don't have to indicate the core symptoms of depression on the questionnaire. But the total score can reflect, oh, this person is in a mild state of depression, but maybe not really. Maybe that's actually reflective of some kind of other metabolic disorder that's influencing some of their behavioral disturbances and behavioral symptoms. So that's another really important point that is not, I would say, specifically discussed online, because this is when you actually look at the nitty gritty of some of the details of the research, there's a lot of moderating variables that mediate this relationship between diet quality and actual depression risk or depression outcomes.
Yeah, I have so many follow-up questions. I think something I need to ask, whether it's a non sequitur or actually applies to this direct chat, is how much can the average person listening to this who's not, doesn't have clinical or subclinical depression take away? Like, I think what people, what somewhat normal logic would imply is like, okay, on a scale of happiness to sadness, a depression person is on, again, by the way, totally on purpose oversimplifying and kind of in a crude way here. They are on the scale of happiness to sadness on the most sad and like pessimistic scale. I might not be there, but can I take what the research says helps those people, can I assume that it will also help me move along the spectrum? Or is it is that an extrapolation that you would at least just maybe put some hesitation on?
I do, because of a couple of things. Another really important variable in this is whether or not you have an inflammatory medical condition, because we know that in that way, there's going to be a higher incidence of depression for people. You know, people with IBS, as an example, there's a higher rates of depression and anxiety. So we understand from that perspective that if you do change your diet, particularly if your baseline diet is devoid of what we would consider, right, to be a healthy dietary pattern, and then you change to include all of those foods that we would want you to, you're likely going to experience maybe some kind of benefit. You know, there, like, maybe there's some mental clarity, maybe there's some potential change in mood, but that again is like really hard to determine, because there's so many other factors that are going to influence whether or not that's what's actually going to happen for a person.
Is it more the case that the benefits are exaggerated and poorly extrapolated than that they are completely made up? And is the problem with the exaggeration / improper extrapolation application, is the problem with that is that it distracts people from other interventions?
Yes, definitely, because it is very exaggerated. Sure, we know that eating a healthy diet is important for a million reasons. And outside of mental health, it's important for a million reasons. So, but to make this extrapolation from like maybe a couple studies who have made this quote unquote clear, to say that changing your diet is a significant variable in your mental health is very exaggerated, because I do not think at all that it's significant. I think it's more accurate to say it maybe is a variable if you are in a subclinical mild range, if you don't have any inflammatory medical condition, if your baseline diet is really poor, and if you work with a nutrition professional, yeah, probably you probably will get some benefit in mood. But those are really important caveats.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see every day, not working with people with clinical depression, that improving one's health and fitness can improve quality of life in certain ways, but that's not the same as I have clinical depression and the key is for me to eat a carnivore diet and lift weights.
Exactly. And like, this is, and again, like another distortion is, you know, like online, it's presented at that conventional mental health, we think of the mind and body as separate. We don't, we've never, it's been decades where we haven't thought about that. We've always known that taking care of physical health is extremely connected to taking care of one's mental health. I mean, it's part of usually a person's treatment plan when we know that that's not something someone is doing, right? So of course there is this connection, and of course there's going to be a benefit if you put effort into taking care of your physical health. I mean, I also think there's another thing probably going on, which is that if you're doing that, you're not withdrawing. You're not doing things that a depressed person would do. Usually depressed people are very isolatory. They withdraw. There's a lack of movement. There's a lack of things. But then if you start re-engaging, right, and taking care of your health, well, now not you're just, you know, you're doing things for your physical health, but now you're not actively participating in behaviors that are going to reinforce your depressive state. So I also think that that's probably a portion of what's going on for people too.
Yeah, I think you're slightly less cynical than I am I think, you know, you saying that people misunderstand that you guys being people who actually study and work in this field day to day, that there's apparently some misunderstanding that you guys don't think that the mind and the body are connected. I don't think it's a misunderstanding. I just think that that's really a really like adjacent rhetoric to, you know, big pharma. They just want to keep you sick. They just want to put you on meds and they don't want to sell you lifestyle. And so this is really just like repackaged into the mental health space of like, eh, they want to just put you in therapy or put you on SSRIs, and they don't want to tell you that you could just move and lift weights and take your shirt off and eat ribeyes and you'll be fine. And I think that's good to hear you say that, like, no, like it's never been complicated. It's never been confusing for people in the know that, like, yeah, the diet and exercise more so exercise, which you've emphasized, which I think is powerful, is like, hey, we know that that is on the list of shit that we will try to help you to do because we know it matters. But the exaggeration, and it's the same exact thing with my field, you know, whatever, we're in a very tangential fields, but like,
yeah,
I'm not fighting battles quite often. I'm fighting more battles of distraction than I am complete mis and disinformation. Like, those exist too, but you know, if someone's like, hey, you know, whatever, I'm not even worrying about example because it could be anything you could think of, from food dyes to seed oils to whatever, it's like I'm fighting the battle of like, you're so focused on this that you're now distracted from, you're worried about whether or not you're cooking in seed oil and tallow, but you do 0 minutes of physical activity. Like, we have our shit backwards, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And that's that could be the consequence. People can start pouring their resources right into supplements, into diet changes, into like whatever, but it's self-healing circle programs and whatever. And then it's removing them farther and farther away from the help that they may have access to, or, you know, like, or need to put their energy into trying to have access to.
Yeah. Yeah. We have ADHD / autism and gut health on the docket. And I mean, I have extra time here, but those are huge topics. Do we want to try and tackle at least a bit of a very similar thread of what we do and don't know about diet and ADHD autism?
Sure.
By the way, I don't mean to package those two things together as if they are the same thing at all, but I think that they're just two very common things that the food dyes, you know, causing hyperactivity and increased rates of autism from hyper palatable ultra processed foods. And just, I'd love to hear you word vomit on what we do and what we don't know and how you think of these things.
Totally. Both of those disorders are extremely complex in their etiology. They're extremely complex. Their ADHD is considered a neurodevelopmental disorder, and it's extremely complex. I mean, we understand certain ways that which it affects the brain. Emotion regulation is one of those, obviously impulsivity and attention, but there's discrepancy in people who have clinical depression in terms of how things present. There's some discrepancy, particularly there's gender differences in how ADHD gets presented. So it can be a little complex in that way. But the research that we have looking at, let's say, diet and ADHD, also not impressive. There's no good evidence at all that supports that specific ingredients like food dyes or even sugar on its own causes ADHD. There's no causal link.
So where is that misunderstanding being, you know, purported?
So it's interesting because if you look at some of the studies related to diet and ADHD, it's really muddied because there's expectancy effects. So the parents are changing the kids' diets and they're being asked to then observe the behavior and to see if there's changes. That's going to influence a parent's perspective. And also, you're so hopeful in that state as a parent. You're so hopeful that you want your child to change. And so you're like, oh, an intervention. So there's a huge influence, psychological influence that's not reliable in terms of actually trying to measure this. So there's just no good evidence, even for autism. There is no good support evidence at all that changing one's diet to a gluten-free diet or an elimination diet is going to make significant changes in that person's life. And also with ADHD and autism, I think that sometimes this is unspoken, a lot of times there's sensory issues. So some kids or some adolescents or even adults, they can only eat certain foods because there's a sensory issue involved. And it has nothing to do with, you know, the calories or whatever. It's completely different. And so if you're asking someone to eliminate foods limited, you know, from their diet that's already very limited, it's probably going to do more detriment to anything. And if you're doing some kind of elimination diet, like a gluten-free diet, when it's not appropriate, you know, we know that there's potential nutritional deficiencies that can end up resulting. So there's really no good, unless there's some medical necessity to do some kind of elimination diet, there's no good reason to experiment with that.
Yeah. Do you think that there ever could be, like, from what I'm hearing, like, first of all, just the getting a definitive diagnosis on these things is challenging. And then, you know, shit, man, measuring change without placeboing somebody without blindness, not actual blindness, but like from a study perspective, blindness is really challenging. Like, if you're like right now you're saying, hey, that's just not an evidence-based thing to try and could have downs, just likely has downsides, mostly because there's no definitive upside. Do you hold any hope for a type of study that could be done that would answer that question a little bit more definitively? Or is it too complicated?
Totally. I mean, honestly, like as a clinician, I am invested in knowing what treatments work for people. And that would just be another tool in my toolbox. I think what's missing is in the diet and depression research, there really needs to be better control groups. Like, I think if we're trying to make a statement about diet, compare it to another diet that has as many interventions as the experimental group, the same exact interventions. Let's measure them over the course of a significant time period. Because again, all the, you know, the research studies are limited in nature in terms of like the time that's spent, you know, adhering to diet. So that's what's really missing in order to make a more informed decision about what dietary pattern are we saying is better than X, right? We need better methodology in order to make that kind of statement.
Yeah, super, it feels, what this is your expertise, it feels not insurmountable, but I get exhausted at the amount of challenges or speed bumps or roadblocks in coming to a conclusion that's even remotely definitive. And I'm a new parent. My daughter's 7 months, and I think about, you know, this stuff a lot, and I think about how complicated behavioral disorders are. I just think that there's just so many inputs. It's so hard to isolate this variable. I mean, you could isolate this variable by changing nothing else, but between families and between experiences that children are having, there's so many other inputs that are hard to control. You know, what's family life like? You know, you know, what other social interactions does the kid have? What social interactions did they have growing up? What were, you know, other incidents of trauma? I just think that there's so many, it's difficult to isolate that variable. And I'm not so, you know, defeatist as if it's impossible for us to ever have a bit more of an idea about this. But yeah, I just, it feels like a really challenging thing to study.
It is. It's very challenging for all of those things that you stated. And I think it's also really challenging now because if you're familiar with the SMILES trial, which we can go into a little bit if you want to, but that's being held up as the standard in terms of, see, this is the evidence. This is the goal that we now have to make this new determination that diet has to be this new intervention that need, you know, that significantly helps with depression. And it just isn't it. Like, it's just not it. And unfortunately, I think studies have now modeled their methodology around the SMILES trial, which doesn't give us new information. It's just regurgitating the same information, in my opinion, because you're using the same methodology and the same interventions. It's not adding to the evidence base, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm going to read the conclusion of the SMILES trial, and I'd love for you to break it down.
Sure.
It's something I'm loosely familiar with. Their conclusion, I'll read the conclusion, I think it's fun to work backwards from, is these results indicate that dietary improvement may provide an efficacious and accessible treatment strategy for the management of this highly prevalent mental disorder, the benefits of which could extend to the management of common comorbidities. That last part probably true, just because improving diet can improve other stuff too. But let's talk a little bit about what the SMILES trial is, if it's something that you feel is just indicating a lot of clinical practice.
So it was a 12-week trial, and I think they had like a 60-something participants. And the strength of this trial is that they used a clinically depressed population. So basically, they had these individuals split into two groups. And one group was the intervention group, and they changed their diet to reflect a Mediterranean-style pattern. And the control group that they had was what they called a befriending group. So the experimental group received 7 weeks, I believe, of individual nutrition counseling by a registered dietitian. They used motivational interviewing, goal setting, and mindful eating. I believe that was another intervention used. And for 12 weeks, and for the control group, what they did there in terms of the befriending group, they had them meet at the same frequency that the experimental group met with the registered dietitian, because they tried to attempt to control for that kind of contact. And at the end of the trial, they said, there was such, the effect size is enormous. It's like minus 1.16, which is insane to see in any sort of research trial. And they said that, you know, there's clinically significant improvements in depression in a clinically depressed population while changing your diet to reflect a Mediterranean style pattern. And so they kind of came up with this kind of conclusion. My problem is how did we isolate diet as an independent variable when we had 4 to 5 other interventions part of the experiment, and the control group in no way really controlled for those factors that they kind of intended to control? And so the conclusion, I think, is well exaggerated, and it doesn't actually reflect what I think the true conclusion is. I think the true conclusion is that with significant professional support to change your diet, then you may be able to decrease your symptoms of depression. But I think what likely is going on is there's this significant rapport that has been developed, you know, through this kind of contact. And we know this because psychotherapy outcomes are inherent in this kind of patient-centered care process, right? The strongest predictor for people to get better and mental health outcomes is the relationship that you have with your therapist. That's the strongest predictor. So if you have a good relationship with the person that you're working with for 12 weeks, and you were given food hampers, you were given like these are really strong interventions to change behavior. Motivational interviewing alone is a really strong intervention to change behavior. So it's not an isolated variable. And if we go right, in order to make a causal statement, we have to make sure that we're isolating the independent variable, which in this case is the dietary intervention. Otherwise, we can't say anything really definitively.
When it comes down to it, you're working with a patient client. You're kind of triaging. You're like, hey, where is this person on this scale of readiness for XYZ intervention? What's going to be the things that are going to have the biggest impact? Are you personally ever getting to a discussion on diet, or is it so far down what you know to be efficacious, or are you slipping it in of like, hey, maybe improvement in health provides you physical opportunities to do things that you enjoy. Now you've lost a little weight, you're a little stronger, you can go for that hike, you can, you know, and again, these are already assumptions that somebody's ready to do any of those things, but is it even making the conversation for you?
Barely. And there's really good reason for that, because there's all these other significant, usually when I see somebody, I'm not seeing somebody preventatively, I'm seeing somebody because the house is burning already. And so there's so many other priorities that are in front of content of diet, because the other thing that I'm looking for is like, is someone eating? Yeah. Is someone eating enough? Is someone overeating? Because that within itself is highly important to address before I'm like, you should eat a Mediterranean style breakfast every day, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the people don't like hearing that the single most important part of your diet is calories, you know, like people eating too many calories and too little calories is the first part of, you know, line of defense here for sure. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. I think I'm doing it too, which is like not fully grasping the severity of what we're talking about here in terms of clinical depression and when somebody might actually be sitting in front of you, and overemphasizing, because mm-hmm. I'm coming from a health and fitness space, overemphasizing the benefit, extrapolating from people who don't have clinical or subclinical issues, extrapolating that to people that do. And yeah, not fully grasping the severity of their situation, exaggerating the benefit of diet and exercise when you're like, yeah, you know, it's like barely on the list, exercise more so, which I think is something that will stick with me. But yeah, it's good. It's interesting to hear you say, yeah, we're, you know, I'm hoping my clients are eating enough. You know, I hope they're eating at all.
Exactly. Exactly. Like that disturbance within itself has to be addressed. And usually, right, when it comes to clinical depression, usually there's a lot of fatigue. There's a lot of sadness. There's a lot of withdrawal from activities that we know can be really useful for people. And there's a lot of distorted ways of thinking. There's so much else to address in therapy that diet is just so far down on the list. And that's not me saying like I'm ignoring a potential novel treatment. I'm just saying like, if we're looking at this in the constellation of other evidence-based interventions along with the context of the person and their symptoms, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a parent and you hear a headline, like one that's probably going around quite a bit now, given current events, that, oh, Red 40 is causing hyperactivity in children. What do you do with that information? I'm curious where that comes from, because if you just Google it, it will say some studies have linked Red 40 to hyperactivity in children. What are some studies, and what conclusions have ultimately created this, you know, so-called link? I mean, how strong is that? How poorly phrased is that? What do we do with that sentence?
So I haven't looked at the details of any of the studies that have stated that. And if I had to surmise or make any sort of guess around that, I would think that it has to be similar to some of the other stuff that we see related to diet and food and mental health. And that there's probably, because there's a lot of methodological considerations. I know that that's kind of what I'm emphasizing when I'm talking about research, is that because that's what's important to help us make a determination about any sort of causal link. So if you're a parent and you hear that, A, just know that that's a very exaggerated claim, and it's highly emotional, because obviously you're a parent and you're hearing this, and it's gonna cause this like red flag, this emotional sort of feeling of, oh my God. And of course you want to do the best thing for your child. So you're in a position where you feel like, oh my God, I need to pay attention to this. But really, in truth, you don't need to pay attention to that, because why are we arguing about Fruit Loops being included in a child's diet when we probably should be talking about how to, like, maybe if they like Fruit Loops, cool, but maybe like give them an orange and an orange at the same time, right? Like, you know, it's distracting from the core thing that we're trying to sort of determine here, or trying to solve, right? So you have full permission to ignore any of those kind of very exaggerated claims, because they aren't very evidence-based, and it's very distracting from the issue.
Yeah, I'd love to read. So there's, again, if you're like, there's sometimes a danger in being like mildly scientifically literate, like just enough to be dangerous. You'll find your way to a 2012 meta-analysis of attention deficit hyperactive disorder, hyperactivity disorder, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, symptoms, restriction diet, and synthetic food color additives. And you could jump to the conclusion that reads, a restriction diet benefits some children with ADHD, effects of food colors were notable but susceptible to publication bias, or were derived from small, non-generalizable samples. And if you even just look one section above that, you'll get to a sentence that reads, the effect was reliable but did not survive correction bias for possible publication bias, and was not reliable in studies confined to FDA approved food colors. So like this, the best studies we have on this didn't survive correction for possible bias, was not reliable in studies confined to the shit that you're actually consuming, like to stuff that's actually allowed via the FDA, that's in your food. And so there's just like so much words. Like the first time I pulled that up, I was like, oh shit, am I about to like, did I misunderstand this? And then again, not even looking at the paper, you can derive wildly different conclusions from what this paper is. But it is fascinating that there's like a, I don't know, maybe it's not fascinating. I'm coming at it from a parental perspective, where you're probably thinking, I'll do anything. I'll try anything. So I want to be a little sympathetic to that, of like, all right, well, let's do everything and let's see what happens.
Yes.
And I'm sympathetic to that position. But I think the issue that we are honing in on here is the distraction from potentially more important things, like what you said, which was like, yeah, if you swap out Red 40 for like beta carotene in these Fruit Loops, like, you're still feeding your child an ultra processed thing, which I'm not demonizing in isolation, but
totally.
Like, you're probably better off being like, okay, instead of quitting my job so I can be outside of Kellogg's every day, you know, holding the white picket fence or holding like a white sign, like maybe I add some, you know, whole food. I add an orange and a couple of eggs with my kid's breakfast. That's probably a more fruitful way, you know, pun intended, of going, you know?
Exactly. And that's just missed. It's just missed on social media. I know you had also mentioned, right, like looking at gut health. So I don't know if you want to kind of get a little bit into that.
I'd love to do that. I have some time. Yeah. I have some extra time, but I want to be respectful. What are you looking at?
Yes, I have some extra time too.
Wonderful.
No, that's cool.
Let it
rip. It's important. So I'd love to talk about it. So the research looking at the gut microbiome, its contents, its constituents, and then what that means in terms of specific mental health disorders and outcomes is really hairy. It's very, very new, and there's a lot of hypothesized mechanisms right now. So, but there's a couple of consistent findings. So like one consistency is that there seems to be more a disturbance in the composition of the gut microbiome associated with specific mental health disorders like depression, like ADHD, for example. But we don't really know if that's a function of having depression. Like, does the gut microbiome become disturbed after we have pathology? Is that a concurrent phenomenon, meaning is this happening at the same time symptoms are going on? Or is it a precursor, you know, to the development of depression or something like that? We really have no clarity on that point, like literally at all. But here's the consistency. The consistency is that there seems to be more pro-inflammatory microbes than non-inflammatory microbes with people who have specific mental health disorders. The other kind of interesting thing is that specifically with major depressive disorder, there may be some potential causal link with a specific strain. I think it's Egertella. Don't quote me, but I think that's what it is. But that's very, very new. That's very, very new. And there needs to be replication studies related to that. But there's a few studies that are looking into that. And that seems actually kind of interesting. So, but we don't know anything in terms of like what that means with respect to treatment. There's no prescription that we can tell people yet that says, okay, based on what we know now, this is what you should be doing in order to, let's say, relieve symptoms of depression. We just don't have that information whatsoever.
Where does this connection begin? Because I think it highlights just another moment of mechanisms versus outcomes, where it's like, hey, like, is there some sort of connection between gut and brain? And maybe there's, you know, where are the mechanistic rationales that probably began this whole, you know, 90%, whatever, we'll talk about serotonin in your gut and all of that stuff. But, you know, you have people like Gary Brecka saying mental health disorders originate in the gut. Now, I will say from what when I hear Gary say literally anything, but is he's extrapolating on a half a partial truth. He's mm-hmm. rephrasing this in a way that suits his, you know, hopefully at the end of the day, his bottom line. So where is the mechanistic rationale where you're like, yeah, cool, this is true. We don't know necessarily what that means in terms of outcomes, but let's talk a little bit about this air quote gut brain connection and what we do know.
Totally. There definitely is an obsession related to this as a concept. I think potentially where some of those claims maybe have been exaggerated from is that, so yes, we do have a vagus nerve. It's part of what connects the brain and the gut. And we do have an enteric nervous system. And that is sort of like, that's the gut's nervous system, right? So all of that is true. The other thing that's true is, yes, our gut does produce certain neurotransmitters. In fact, more than just serotonin, it produces glutamate, GABA, all the things. And there is some evidence, right, that the neurotransmitters produced in the gut are able to communicate, send signals to the brain via the vagus nerve and potentially other byproducts that they end up making in the gut. But again, we just don't know what that means. Like, okay, so we know that there's like signaling, we know that there's some level of communication, but we don't know what that translates to. Like, we don't know if that means like, okay, that means my symptom of depression is going to be worsening because there's additional serotonin being, like, we have no idea what that even means. So I think that's probably where all of that stuff got extrapolated from, just like this, you know, really rough idea. Oh my God, there's serotonin in the gut. And so like serotonin is important for our mood. And so this has to be so significant and life changing.
Let's talk about that specifically. Let's talk about this quote you will see thrown around all day long, which is 90% of the serotonin in your body is made in your gut. So what does that mm-hmm. mean? Where are people misunderstanding the application of that?
So yeah, so there is gut-derived serotonin, there's gut-derived GABA, there's gut-derived lots of neurotransmitters. But the thing is, with neurotransmitters and where they are produced, is that the function of those neurotransmitters depends on where they are in the body and where they can travel to. Your gut neurotransmitters are not able to cross into the blood-brain barrier. Your brain has a very protective layer around it and only lets very select few things into it, which is on purpose. And it does not allow gut-derived neurotransmitters to be allowed into the brain. a byproduct, tryptophan, is allowed to, you know, into the brain. And so that's kind of thought of as, okay, well, if tryptophan is allowed to be in the brain, maybe that helps to increase serotonin because it's a precursor for serotonin. But yeah, the gut-derived neurotransmitters are responsible for things like your gut needs, like peristalsis, like the movement of your intestines, like all that other stuff. It's used for that. It's not in control of your mood, your learning and behavior. That gets produced in your brain. You're part of your brain stem, and another part of your brain is where all of the brain-derived neurotransmitters come from and are produced. And those are the things that are responsible for our behavior, mood, learning, and all of that.
Yeah, I think it is. There's cool. People learn about the vagus nerve. They hear words like gut-brain axis. They hear about gut-brain connection. They hear about 90% of your serotonin's made in your gut. They're like, serotonin has to do with I feel good, I'm happy. You know, they know about SSRIs. They know about other things to do with serotonin. And it just becomes like my question. The irony is like, let's say that's all, like, forget the serotonin for a second, because I think that's a very easy thing to just, what you mentioned, which is like, cool, it's like, it's made, yeah, a lot of the serotonin is made in your gut and stays in your gut. It doesn't have the same impact as serotonin in the brain. But the idea that there's a gut-brain connection, like, okay, I think that when there is a gut-brain connection, if you really think about it, that doesn't tell us anything. Like, it's an interesting sentence, but it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't implicate treatment in any way, and treatment in a clinical setting, but also treatment in like an individual lifestyle perspective. Mm-hmm. When, you know, like even if it did, the things we know about some fleeting objective healthy gut, we don't really even know what that means.
Yeah.
The things we would know, if you had to make a list of things that you're like, yeah, this probably supports good gut health, it's just normal basic stuff. It's mm-hmm. It's like going outside and exercising and, you know, taking care of your metabolic health and, you know, diversification of diet and not smoking or too much alcohol and not, you know, living on antibiotics or whatever. Like what are people like hoping to, I don't know. When people talk about the gut-brain connection, I'm like, yeah, okay, they're like, well, there's a gut-brain connection. I really got to take care of my gut. I'm like, well, what does that mean? And I'm like, they're like, oh, like if you actually look at like what we actually know about what that means, which is very little, it's probably a list of shit you already knew you should have been doing.
Totally. I think the thing that this gets put into, I don't know, I have a lot of thoughts about this stuff, but you know how the big wellness people love to talk about how all disease begins in the gut, and like their Jesus of Hippocrates has made this declaration. And this is just confirmation bias. This is confirmation bias in action. It's like, okay, you already have that worldview that all disease begins in the gut. And then you like, here's somebody who's actually smart talk about the gut-brain axis and that this fact of, you know, neurotransmitters being produced in your gut. And you're like, use that as a way to establish authority about being a gut microbiome expert or knowing something else that conventional mental health people don't actually know. And then you manipulate that narrative and you try to sell your gut healing protocol to people, right? You try to sell your, like, your gut supplements because that's what's going to, like, improve your mood. I mean, I feel like it's all part of that trash bin, you know.
Every gut health specialist I've ever talked to, and there have been a few, like, gut health specialists already is a cringe thing. Like, there are people that are gut health specialists, but I just mean people who research this stuff, who it's their life's work. They are the biggest people, the biggest I don't know people that I've ever talked to. I mean, they are totally fascinated with the gut, but it might be the single least understood but seemingly most understood thing that we talk about. And I just find that to be like, anytime someone mentions it, I'm like, guys, the people who know the most about this are the first people to tell you we don't know shit about shit. And for people to talk so unbelievably, just in very like declarative ways about it, very hyperbolic, very sure of things. You know, I think you should be relatively skeptical about very hyperbolic people that are, you know, selling in absolutes. I would absolutely be skeptical mm-hmm. about that. But this might be the thing I'd be the most skeptical about, people who are very sure of gut and gut-related mm-hmm. things you should be doing.
Totally. And then, like, they kind of have to be, right? Because if they're selling something, they have to be sure that this is what's going to work for you. And that's what they're going to present.
Absolutely. Anything we missed looking back all the way to exercise and depression? Anything that you were like, yeah, I'd be remiss if we didn't bring this up?
Not necessarily, unless just another maybe myth, like, you know, I don't want this to be too much of a tangent, but something like, you know, trauma stored in the body. There's a lot of really basic mental health myths that exist on social media. And I hate all of them, but I would say that, yeah, trauma stored in the body is a big one. Because that's another statement that's like, what are you talking about, right? Like, you just made this really bold claim, and I don't even know what you're actually saying. And so what's true is that, you know, when you go through traumatic experiences where you go through very extremely chronic stressors in your life, your cognitive capacity changes, your physical capacity can change as a function of just experiencing things that are extraordinarily difficult and stressful to you. And it's not that trauma is stored in the body or in the fascia. That's another thing that I hear all the time, and that you have to release it through these somatic practices. I know your eyes are going wild. Jesus. And I'm so glad that maybe you haven't heard about this, because then you're safe. But yeah, there's the solution to this is that you have to do somatic exercises in order to release the trauma that is stored in your body. And the thing is, there's a lot of other really good evidence-based trauma interventions that are way more appropriate, and not something like that you have to go to like a chiropractic, you know, release session because of something you experienced when you were 10.
Preying on people with trauma might be like all time fucked up. That might be all time fucked up.
It is absolutely awful, because they're one of the most vulnerable population looking sincerely for answers. And I read a great Reddit thread. Sometimes I go on Reddit and look at these groups because I think it's actually excellent. I read a great thread that was kind of trashing the holistic psychologist, because I love that as a topic. And someone said, and I didn't think about this piece, but this is so true, is that if you are a person who has gone through traumatic events and you still have that unresolved, so to speak, in your life, and it's still affecting you, you are kind of constantly seeking supportive messages and validation, because it's so much in contrast to what it is that you experienced. And so when someone like the holistic psych says, you know, like all of these things, and here's the solution, and it is so emotionally appealing, and it seems like, oh my God, it's so supportive, like she understands what I'm feeling. And it's such a psychological and emotional trap for people. It is so intensely manipulative. And I want people to know this, because I just, you know, want to understand the mechanisms that are at action here. But it is horrible.
To me, it's one of those things where, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's one of those things where, so if you asked him or her, I don't even know, I've seen you talk about him or her, his or her account, but it's one of those things, not unlike the carnivore diet, not unlike a lot of different dietary tribes, where the people who are advocates for it have been inundated with a much higher percent of people who are expressing positive responses that they reinforce. Maybe they didn't even fully believe what they were saying in the first place, but they've had a lot of testimonials of people that have positive outcomes. Sometimes I fight this with like in a much less important niche of like reverse dieting, where people are like, I did this thing and it helped. And it's like, yeah, but first of all, it didn't help for the reason that you think it helped. And for every one of you, there's 10 people who it harmed that you don't hear about. And for you, the person who it did help, we could have helped you without harming those 10 people. Like, you're not aware of the collateral damage. And this strikes me as one of those moments where, if you look at the comments, there are probably people like, yay, that was totally me and it totally helped. And the person then posting it, it's like, yeah, see, I'm doing good. This is true. It's true inversely through being affirmed by others, not actually inherently true. But you don't hear about the people who have been harmed by things like that. You just don't hear about
it. Yeah, you don't. And if someone comments on a post indicating that they did maybe experience some harm, a lot of times that's deleted. A lot of times those people are blocked. Like, there's a lot of appearance keeping up with on social media, if that's where you're looking. So there's no fair, informed representation whatsoever.
Every field needs a carnivore cringe. I don't know if you follow carnivore cringe.
Yes.
Every field needs that. I don't know, for the listener, if you don't know, the account Carnivore Cringe is an account that basically like aggregates a lot of these negative experiences that people are having that are often silenced, and it's basically like screenshots of people in Facebook groups that are like, my LDL's 350, my doctor's freaking out, like, what should I do? And it's like people commenting under it, like, you know, have you, maybe you need to increase your fats, or like some just fucking asinine comment. Every field needs a carnivore cringe who's aggregating these, like, hey guys, there are people having negative experiences too, promise.
Totally. But it's so, you see that, and obviously, like, you know, you on the other side can look at that and be like, how could someone recommend? But it's, groupthink is so powerful. I mean, that's at play. That the psychology of that is at play, looking at those messages and those accounts.
Yeah.
And that's how strong that is. It's scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't ever, like, if you were talking to somebody who is saying, hey, I eat this up and it aids me and I feel it's helped me. Like, I don't want to take that away from someone, but I can't help but shake this collateral damage of like, I'm happy for you in isolation that this has mm-hmm. already happened and you've had a good outcome, but I promise this is doing more harm than good. And that's, you fight that all day in the comments, because if I talk about seed oils being not so bad, someone's like, hey, I cut out seed oils, my life got better in some way. And I'm like, yeah, like, I'm happy for you as a human that your life is better.
Right.
But just, you know, and I almost like don't, I'm not here to like, just like shit on an experience you've had. Of course not. But I'm always like typing out like, but it's not for the reason that you thought it was. And there's people that have, and I'm like, you know what? Like, you cool. You had a good experience. Like, what am I doing? You know? And sometimes I'm like, no, they need to know, because if in the future, in a very similar way with this trauma is stored in the body, like, what about in the future? If turns out that that high you've been on, kind of just suckling at this idea, goes away, like, you know, you will now be left with even more shame about fixing your problem, you know? And so, yeah, it hurts.
Yeah, it does. It hurts. But I know. I mean, but I think this is in podcasts, right? This is where people can get longer form, more detailed information, and not just these like snippets online that we kind of see if someone's, you know, like open and willing to hear that out. But you can't really beat personal life-changing experience for someone, right? It's hard to then say, well, look at this. That's kind of in contrast to all of that.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. Let's end things on a positive note. You know, if you're, gosh, I think one of the biggest take-homes for today is just the complexity of a lot of this stuff. So when even any attempt to kind of summarize succinctly is challenging. And so when I say, you know, I have a note here. I have a thing that I sent you. It's like top things that are actually proven to, air quote, improve mental health. I just already feel like that's a challenging thing. But if you were forced to answer and give some things, where would you go?
Okay, so on a very basic level, if you are struggling with your mental health, if you're noticing some kind of change in your baseline, if you feel kind of off, that is the time to start seeking help. Because usually things will snowball. Like I said before, right? People usually don't contact me until the house is burning. I've never really had someone contacting me, right? Noticing certain symptoms and they want to get help. It's kind of unheard of. So, but if you're noticing some change in your mood, some aspect of your functioning is deteriorating or being disturbed, please seek out a licensed mental health professional, because that is the most appropriate form of help that you could try to access. At the very least, they'll give you an evaluation and sort of let you understand, you know, potentially what's going on. So I really want to highlight that, because that by far is going to be the first line recommendation versus immediately trying to, like, you know, overhaul your diet, let's say, or overhaul your whole exercise routine. And yes, only mental health professionals are allowed to assess you, are allowed to diagnose you, are allowed to provide treatment interventions ethically. So I also want to be very clear about that. A lot of people will advertise online coaching. There, I've seen anxiety coaching, I've seen depression coaching. Seen a lot of pseudo therapeutic, because they can't legally say therapy,
right?
So they're using other language that's indicating this is like pseudo therapeutic. Please do not entertain that route. Please do not entertain that route. There are great coaches that stay in their scope of practice, but that is not staying within scope of practice.
Yeah, that's super helpful to hear. And there is, you're so right. The language being used can be tricky. Cool. Amazing. Mm-hmm. You've been an incredible guest and provided a ton of really amazing information on topics I think people really do care about. I think mental health deserves a larger megaphone. And so thank you for giving it that. And I appreciate all the work you do on social media. You have an incredible account. I was like scrolling through your reels, just like, I just stalk out the people that are coming on the podcast just to like generate some thoughts. And
yeah.
Listen, some of them have done really well, but all I'm thinking is like, this only has, like, I'm like, this needs like 10 times the amount of interaction. So whatever. I hope you get that. Which you deserve, you know, going
thank
forward.
You yeah. I appreciate you giving me a platform and talking about this, because it's true. I want to demystify, you know, what therapy is for people. I want to like really help people understand the basics of what is necessary and the stuff that you don't need to fall for online.
Yeah Awesome. Do the thing where you tell people where they can find you.
Oh yes, okay. So on Instagram, Feed Your Mental, all one word. My website is same thing, www.feedyourmental.com.
Awesome. Amazing. I'll do the whole show notes thing, and I'll tag you and all the stuff when it comes out. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.